This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org. George Saunders with Michael Silverblatt. Recorded in Santa Fe, April 20th, 2005. George Saunders, called by the Atlantic Monthly the most talented goof-off writing fiction today, has two books of short stories, Pastoralia and Civil War Land in Bad Decline. He reads here from the stories My Guilty Pleasures and A Barber's Unhappiness before joining in conversation with Michael Silverblatt, host of Bookworm.
Good evening, and can you hear me? Oh, good. Those days when you couldn't hear me are over. welcome to the Lensic Center and to the Lannan Foundation series of readings and conversations. It's a pleasure to be here again, and a double pleasure to be here to introduce and talk to George Saunders. In part because, you see, he only has two books, you know? And so I can't over-prepare. But I did call him up and say, you've written some things, haven't you, since those two books? So he sent me a pile of papers. Now, those who thought this was my speech are lucky. he's published two books of short stories. And he has, one of them is called Pastoralia, and one of them, the first one, is Civil War Land in Bad Decline. And these stories are very unusual in that they deal with contemporary issues, but they're set in cages, essentially. He's Mr. Control Group. These casts of characters that he invents are versions of a sociological study. Some of them live, it seems, in theme parks. They're visited by strangers who seem to need them to tell them what the past was like. It's this very strange way of disembodying America. Now, since what we seem to need in fiction is a way to make it new, to put a new frame around it, these strange places that he writes about are kind of idealized centers for the reimagination of America and Americans. So we've got this strange kind of satirical frame in which heartbreaking and terrifying things happen. Now, when I got his new stories, I discovered that the ante of the heartbreaking and the terrifying has, if anything, gone up, which made me call him, or maybe it was an email. By this point, this being the post-industrial society, it's hard to tell whether you've spoken to someone or written to them at this point. But I called him up and said, you know, I think you're one of the members of your generation who gets better and better. Most of the time now, people publish their first collections when they're fresh out of the writing program. Before you know it, they have a contract for the second collection in that good old trunk that held all those novels that you threw away before. It's not there. These people are too young to have that trunk, so they don't get to publish the four or five books that their hearts were set on. They're under contract for the next book, and it's not as good as the first. And then the third, they're under such pressure that they can't do anything at all but bite their fingers. So I'm happy to say that George Saunders is one of the few writers of his generation who gets better and better, funnier, more heartbreaking, and more terrifying, book after book. And I'm happy to introduce him. Thanks.
Thank you, Michael. As I'm sure you know, Michael is one of the great literary minds of our times, and I'm really honored to be on the same stage with him. I'd also like to take this opportunity, of course, to thank Patrick Lannan and the Lannan Foundation, which I'm sure you also know is a really great force for good in the literary universe. They're with the exception of tonight, their taste is impeccable. And so I really am grateful to be part of the extended Lannan family and to come out here and actually meet people in person. So thanks to everybody who made this possible, and thanks to you for coming. I find literary readings a little awkward because we never quite know how to behave. And especially as someone who writes supposedly dark and supposedly funny stories, it's always a tense moment when you try to figure out if your audience will laugh. So I want to read this short piece as kind of a test, really. But it's not a crisis either way, because what we can do is, if it doesn't work out so well, I have a short, it's sort of a thesis on agrarian practices in 17th century England. So if you don't like this funny stuff, it's perfectly fine, and we'll skip it. But if you do laugh, then I have a very sexual, perverse story that I'll read to you. So, but I don't, you know, I'm not from New Mexico, so I don't really know what you want. So I just want to be a good guest. That's all I want. Okay, so this is a piece called My Guilty Pleasures, and it's just a little bit old. You'll see there's a historical reference that's now dated, unfortunately. My Guilty Pleasures. Those of us in the literary game often have guilty pleasures that we indulge in when not translating Cicero from the Latin into the German and then back into Latin to see how funny it sounds. My favorite guilty pleasure is watching the new TV series, The Bachelor, Who Screws the Best?, in which an ugly, poor, middle-aged guy has sex with a series of young women who've been misled into believing that he's handsome, young, and rich, after which he decides which of them to propose to, at which time they're notified that he's actually ugly, poor, and middle-aged. I especially love the moment when Desiree, the series' bad girl, said, "Well, I thought there was a lot of hair on his back, but still, I felt we were really connecting." Also good is the new series, The Bachelor, Actually, He's Dead, in which a group of young women attempt to win the favor of a propped-up, moldering corpse they've been told is a young, handsome, rich guy who's alive. It's still sort of hard for me to believe that none of them, not the lawyer, not the senior account rep, not the homeless advocate, noticed the team of people behind the bachelor moving his limbs via a system of wires, while a tape recorder on his chest emitted sayings such as, "I guess I'm just looking for someone who'll like me for me, even when parts of me fall off." And, "Well, as far as my house goes, all I can say is, it's very small and made of wood." I'm also looking forward to the new series, The Bachelor, So What If I'm a Raccoon?, in which a group of young women live for 6 months in a mansion in the south of France with a raccoon they've been told is a human being who recently came into a lot of money. The last episode, where the young women all gang up on Jake, kill him, make a hat out of his fur, and eat him, promises to be a ratings bonanza. Also worthy of note is the new series, The Hag, in which a very tiny, wiry woman over 100 years old is locked in a mansion in the south of France with 3,000 muscular young men who must fight one another with clubs and mallets to see which of them will be allowed to leave the house. When all of the men but one are gone, she reveals that she's actually a beautiful young heiress, at which time he reveals that he is actually a raccoon. After which she has sex with him, kills him, then makes a hat out of him and wears it to a day spa. But if I had to choose, I guess I'd have to say my favorite guilty pleasure is the new series, How Weird Is That?, in which a group of bureaucrats who've never themselves fought in a war are locked in the decision house and allowed to pick any country in the world for America to go to war with for reasons they invent on the spot. The candid shots of clueless families in the chosen country being blown apart as American bombers pass by overhead, along with the quick cuts back to the decision house, where a group of young women are deciding which of the bureaucrats to marry, having been told the bureaucrats are actually leaders of a great nation, make this a real can't-miss program. Right. Thank you. Thank you very much. All right, so you pass. There's no farming tonight. I lived for a while when my daughters were young in Pittsford, New York, and there was a barbershop across from this bus stop where I wait at every day. And the barber was this older guy who would come out and ogle every woman that he saw. And unlike us civilized people, he had never learned to avert his eyes when he was busted. He would just keep looking at this porn. So because I was a new father and I'd been instantly cured of all misogyny, I decided I would crucify him in literature. But then you find out that literature is not a very effective means of crucifying, because if you don't have love for your character, you don't have a story. But it took me about 4 years to figure that out. So I'd like to read you just the first third or so of this story called The Barber's Unhappiness. And in this little arc, all that happens is boy meets girl, changes his mind, basically. But all the misogyny in the story, of course, is not mine. I interviewed people extensively. Mornings, the barber left his stylist inside and sat out front of his shop, drinking coffee and ogling every woman in sight. He ogled old women, pregnant women, women whose photographs were passing on the sides of buses. And this morning, a woman with close-cropped black hair and tear-stained cheeks, who wouldn't be half bad if she'd just make an effort, clean up her face a little and invest in some decent clothes, some white tights, a short skirt maybe, knee boots, cowboy hat and a cigarillo, say. And he pictured her kneeling on a crude Mexican sofa in a little mud hut, just daring him to take her. And soon they'd screwed their way into some sort of bean field while some gaucho guys played soft guitars. Although actually, he'd better put the gaucho guys behind some trees so they wouldn't get all hot and bothered from watching the screwing and swoop down and stab him and have their way with Miss Hacienda as he bled to death. Well, come to think of it, forget the gauchos. He'd just put some soft guitars on the stereo in the hut and leave the door open. Although actually, what was a stereo doing in a Mexican hut? Were there outlets? Plus, how could he meet her? He could compliment her hair, then ask her out for coffee. He could say that as a hair care professional, he knew a little about hair, and boy, did she ever have great hair, and by the way, did she like coffee? Except they always said no. Lately, no, no, no was all he got. Plus, he had zero access to a bean field or mud hut. Now, they could do it in his yard, but it wouldn't be the same because Jeepers had basically made of it a museum of poop. Plus, Ma would call 911 at the first hint of a sexy moan. Now, those on that meter maid, those were some serious hooters. Although her face was sort of beat. But if you could take those hooters and slap them on Miss Hacienda, wow, then you'd be talking. Just the meter maid's hooters and some decent clothes and a lip wax. And the sexy voice of the librarian who looked away whenever he ogled her, and you'd have his perfect woman. And wow, would they ever be happy together forever, as long as she kept a positive attitude. Which, come to think of it, might be an issue, because why the heck was she crying in public? Miss Hacienda passed through a gap in a hedge and disappeared into the Episcopal Church. Why was she going into a church on a weekday? Maybe she had a problem. Maybe she was knocked up. Maybe if he followed her into the church and told her he knew a little about problems, having been born with no toes, she'd have coffee with him. He was tired of going home to just Ma. Lately, she'd been falling asleep with her head on his shoulder while they watched TV. Sometimes he worried that somebody would look in the window and wonder why he married such an old lady. But sometimes he worried that Ma would wake up and catch him watching that black girl in the silver bikini riding her horse through that tidal pool in slow motion on 1-900 Dream Gal. He wondered how Miss Hacienda would look in a silver bikini in slow motion. Although, if she was knocked up, she shouldn't really be riding a horse. She should be sitting down, taking it easy. Somebody should be bringing her a cup of tea. She should move in with him and Ma. He wouldn't rub it in that she was knocked up. He'd be loving about it. He'd be a good friend to her and wouldn't even try to screw her. And pretty soon she'd start wondering why not and start really wanting him. He'd be her labor coach and cheerfully change diapers in the wee hours. And finally, when she'd lost all the weight, she'd come to his bed and screw his brains out in gratitude. After which he'd have a meditative smoke by the window and decide to marry her. He nearly got tears in his eyes thinking of how she'd get tears in her eyes as he went down on one knee to pop the question. A nice touched adult who'd knocked her up wouldn't have thought of in a million years the Nimrod. And that SOB could drive by as often as he wanted, deeply regretting his foolishness as the baby frolicked in the yard. It was too late. They were a family, and nothing would ever break them up. But he'd have to remember to stick a towel under the door while meditatively smoking, or Ma would have a cow. Because after he smoked, she always claimed everything smelled like smoke and made him wash every piece of clothing in the house. And he'd better screw quietly if they weren't married, because Ma was old-fashioned. It was sort of a pain living with Ma. But Miss Hacienda had better be prepared to tolerate Ma, who was actually pretty good company when she stayed on her meds. And so what if she was nearly 80 and went around the house flossing in her bra? It was her damn house. You better never hear Miss Hacienda say a word against Ma, who'd paid his way through barber college, like, for example, asking why Ma had thick sprays of gray hair growing out of her ears. Because that would kill Ma, who was always reminding the gas man she'd been a dish in high school. How would Miss Hacienda like it if after a lifetime of hard work, she got wrinkled and forgetful, and some knocked-up slut dressed like a Mexican cowgirl moved in and started complaining about her ear hair? Who did Miss Hacienda think she was, the Queen of Sheba? She could go into labor in the damn Episcopal Church, for all he cared. He'd keep wanking it in the pantry on the little milking stool for the rest of his life before he'd let his Ma be hurt, and that was final. As Miss Hacienda came out of the church, she saw a thick-waisted, beak-nosed, middle-aged man rise angrily from a wooden bench and stomp into Mickey's hairport, slamming the door behind him. Next morning, Ma wanted an omelet. When he said he was running late, she said, "Never mind," in a tone that made it clear she was going to accidentally, on purpose, burn herself again, while ostensibly making her own omelet. So he made the omelet. When he asked, was it good, she said it was fine, which meant it was bad. Then he had to make pancakes, so he made pancakes. Then he kissed her cheek and flew out the door very, very late for driving school. Driving school was being held in what had been a trendy office park in the Carter years and was now a flat, white, overgrown stucco bunker with tinted windows and a towable signboard that said Derving School. Inside was a conference table that filled most of a room that smelled like a conference table sitting in direct sunlight with some spilled burned coffee on it. "Latecomers will be beaten," said the driving school instructor. "Sorry," said the barber. "Joking," said the instructor, thrusting a disorderly wad of handouts at the barber who was trying to get his clip-ons off. "What I was just saying was that our aim is we're going to be looking at some things or aspects in terms of driving. Meaning safety? Meaning, is speeding something we do in a vacuum? Or could it involve a pedestrian or fatality or family out for a fun drive? And then you, here you come, speeding, with the safety or destiny of that family not held firmly in your mind? And what happens next? Who knows?" "A crash," said someone. "An accident," said someone else. "Crash or accident, both could," said the instructor. "Either one might or may, because I've seen in my CPR role as a paramedic, when many times, and I'm sorry if you find this gross or too much, I've had to sit in a rescue vehicle with a cut-off arm or hand, even of a kid, a really small arm or even limb, just weeping as if I hadn't been thoroughly trained, as I know none of you have, but I have. And why was I holding that small arm or limb and bawling? Because of someone like you yourselves, good people. I know you are. I'm not saying that. But you decided what? What did you decide? Or they? That person who cut off that kid's arm I was carrying that day, I was just saying. No one knew. They decided to speed is what you did," said the instructor sadly, with pity for both the armless child and the otherwise good people who on that fateful day had decided to speed and now sat before him, life's ruined. "I didn't hit nobody," said a girl in a t-shirt that said buggin'. "The cop just stopped me." "But I'm talking the possibility aspect," the instructor said kindly. "I'm talking what happens if you walk away from here a man or woman not changed in her thought patterns by the material I'm about to present you in terms of the visuals and graphics. which some of the things are crashes, and some are working wounds I myself have personally dressed, and some are wounds we downloaded off the internet. So you could have a chance to see wounds that are national. Because why? Because consequences. Because are we on this earth or island? Oh, said the bugging girl, who now seemed chastened and convinced. Outside the tinted window were a little forest and a stream and an insurance agency and a FedEx drop-off tilted by some pipeline digging. There were six students. One was the barber. One was a country boy with a briefcase who took laborious notes and kept asking questions with a furrowed brow, as if, having been caught speeding, he was now considering a career in law enforcement. Did radar work via sonar beams? How snotty did someone have to get before you could stun him with your stun gun? Next to the country boy was the buggin' girl. Next to the buggin' girl was a very, very happy crew-cut older man in a cowboy shirt and bolo tie who laughed at everything and seemed to consider it a great privilege to be here at the Derving School on this particular day with this particular bunch of excellent people, and who by the end of the session had proposed holding a monthly barbecue at his place so they wouldn't lose touch. Across the table from the happy man was a white-haired woman about the barber's age who kept making sly references to films and books the barber had never heard of and rolling her eyes at things the instructor said while writing, "Help me" and "Beam me up" on her notepad and shoving it across the table for the happy man to read, which seemed to make the happy man uncomfortable. Next to the white-haired woman was a pretty girl, a very pretty girl. Whoa. One of the prettiest girls the barber had ever seen. Boy, was she pretty. Her hair was crimped and waist-length, and her eyes were doe-like and Egyptian, and about her there was a sincerity and intelligence that made it hard for him to look away. She certainly looked out of place here at the conference table with one hand before her and a strip of sunlight that shone on a very pretty turquoise ring that seemed to confirm her as someone exotic, darkish, and schooled in things Eastern. Someone you could easily imagine making love to on a barge on the Nile, say. Surrounded by thousands of candles that smelled weird. Or come to think of it, maybe she was American Indian. And he saw her standing at the door of a teepee, wearing that same sincere, intelligent expression as he came home from the hunt with a long string of dead rabbits. Having been accepted into the tribe at her request after killing a cute white rabbit publicly to prove he was a man of the woods, or actually they'd let him skip the rabbit part because he'd spoken to them so frankly about the white man's deviousness and given them secret information about an important fort after first making them promise not to kill any women or children. He pictured one of the braves saying to her as she rubbed two corn cobs together in the dying sunlight near a spectacular mesa that she was lucky to have the barber who had powerful medicine in terms of being a powerful medicine man, and silently she smiled, rubbing the corn cobs together perhaps a little faster, remembering the barber naked in their teepee, although on closer inspection it appeared she was actually probably Italian. The girl looked up and caught him staring at her. He dropped his eyes and began leaping through his course materials. After a number of slides of terrible wounds, the instructor asked, "Did anyone know how many G's a person pulled when he or she went through a windshield at 80 miles per after hitting a bridge abutment or cow?" No one knew. The instructor said, "Quite a few." The happy man said he'd had a feeling it was quite a few, which was why, wasn't it, that people died? The instructor said, "Yes, either that or flying debris or having one's torso absolutely crushed." "I guess that would do it," said the happy man, grinning. "So what's my point?" the instructor said, pointing with his pointer to an overhead of a cartoon man driving a little car toward a tombstone while talking gaily on a car phone. "Say we're feeling good, very good, or bad, which is the opposite. Say we've just had a death or promotion or the birth of a child or a fight with our wife or spouse. But my point is we're experiencing an emotional peak, because what we then maybe forget, whether happy or fighting or sad or glad, whatever, is that 2 tons of car is what? Is the thing you are inside of, driving, and I hope not speeding or otherwise, although for the sake of this pretend example, I'm afraid we have to assume, yes, you are, which is how this next bad graphic occurs. Now on the overhead, the cartoon man's body parts were scattered and his car phone was flying up to heaven on little angel wings. The barber looked at the pretty girl again. She smiled at him. His heart began to race. This never happened. They never smiled back. Well, she was young. Maybe she didn't know better than to smile back at an older guy you didn't want. Or maybe she wanted him. It was possible. Maybe she'd had it with young horny guys just out for quick rolls in the hay. Maybe she wanted someone old enough to really appreciate her, who didn't come too quickly and owned his own business and knew how to pick up after himself. He hoped she was a very strict religious virgin who'd never even had a roll in the hay. Not that he hoped she was frigid. He hoped she was a kind of strict religious virgin who, once married, would let it all hang out. And when not letting it all hang out, would move with quiet dignity and conservative clothes. So that no one would suspect how completely and totally she could let it all hang out when she chose to. And that she came from a poor family and could therefore really appreciate the hard work that went into running a small business and maybe even had some accounting experience and could help with the books. Although truthfully, even if she'd had hundreds of rolls in the hay and couldn't add a stinking row of figures, he didn't care. She was so pretty. They'd work it out. Assuming, of course, she'd have him. And with a sinking heart, he remembered his missing toes. He remembered that day at the lake with Mary Ellen Kofsky, when it had been over 100 and he'd sat on a beach chair fully dressed, claiming to be chilly. A crowd of Mary Ellen's friends had gathered to help her undress him and throw him in, and in desperation, he'd whispered to her about his toes, and she'd gone white and called off her friends, and 2 months later married Phil Ampesto, that idiotic beanpole. God, he was tired of hiding his toes. He wanted to be open about them. He wanted to be loved in spite of them. Maybe this girl had a wisdom beyond her years. Maybe her father had a deformity, a glass eye or facial scar. Maybe through long years of loving this kindly but deformed man, she'd come to almost need the man she loved to be somewhat deformed. Not that he liked the idea of her trotting after a bunch of deformed guys. And also not that he considered himself deformed exactly, although admittedly 10 barely discernible bright pink nubs were no picnic. He pictured her lying nude in front of a fireplace, so comfortable with his feet that she'd given each nub a pet name. And maybe sometimes during lovemaking, she got a little carried away and tried to kiss or lick his nubs. Although certainly he didn't expect that, and in fact found it sort of disgusting. And for a split second thought somewhat less of her. Then pictured himself gently pulling her up, away from his feet. And the slightly shamed look on her face made him forgive her completely for the disgusting thing she'd been about to do out of her deep, deep love for him. The instructor held up a small, bloodied baby doll, which he then tossed across the room into a trunk. "Blammo," he said, "let's let that trunk represent a crypt or tomb. And it's your fault from speeding? How then do you feel?" "Bad," said the bugging girl. The pretty girl passed the barber the attendance log, which had to be signed to obtain course credit and associated conviction waivers, point reductions. They looked frankly at each other for what felt like a very long time. "Okay," the instructor said brightly. "I suppose I don't have to grind you into absolute putty. So now it's a break, so you don't view me as some sort of Marquis de Sade requiring you to watch gross visuals until your mind rots out." The barber took a deep breath. He would speak to her. Maybe buy her a soda. The girl stood up. The barber got a shock. Her face was the same lovely, exotic, intelligent, slim, Cleopatran face, but her body seemed scaled to a head twice the size of the one she had. She was a big girl. Her arms were round and thick. Her mannerisms were a big girl's mannerisms. She hunched her shoulders and tugged at her smock. He felt a little miffed at her for having misled him. And a little miffed at himself for having ogled such a fatty. Well, not a fatty exactly. Her body was okay. It seemed solid enough. It was just too big for her head. If you could somehow reduce the body to put it in scale with the head, or enlarge the head and shrink down the entire package, then you'd have a body that would do justice to that beautiful, beautiful face that even now, tidying up his handouts, he was regretting having lost. "Hi," she said. "Hello," he said, and went outside and sat in his car. And when she came out with two Cokes, he pretended to be cleaning the ashtrays until she went away. So I'm going to stop that story there, but it gets really happy after that and really upbeat. That's it. Thank you. After that, it's a positive love fest. You wouldn't believe it. So I'd like to read one more short story. This is kind of a fantasy on Chicago a little bit. So I'd like to dedicate this to Mary and Sharon, two Chicago homegirls who are here tonight. This is not maybe so funny, but maybe it's a little inadvertently funny. And it's called Bohemians. In a lovely urban coincidence, the last two houses on our block were both occupied by widows who had lost their husbands in Eastern European pogroms. Dad called them the Bohemians. He called anyone white with an accent a Bohemian. Whenever he saw one of the Bohemians, he greeted her by mispronouncing the Czech word for door. Neither Bohemian was Czech, but both were polite. So when Dad said door to them, they answered cordially as if he weren't perennially schlockered. Mrs. Poltoy, the stouter Bohemian, had spent the war in a crawl space, splitting a daily potato with six cousins. Consequently, she was bitter and claustrophobic and loved food. If you ate something while standing near her, she stared at it going into your mouth. She wore only black. She said the Catholic Church was a jeweled harlot drinking the blood of the poor. She said America was a spoiled child, ignorant of grief. When your ball rolled onto her property, she seized it and waddled into her backyard and pitched it into the quarry. Mrs. Hoppenlitsky, on the other hand, was thin and joyfully made pipe cleaner animals. When I brought home one of her crude dogs in top hats, Mom said, "Take over your mold a hero. To her, it will seem like the toy of a king." To Mom, the camps, massacres, and railroad sightings of 20 years before were as unreal as covered wagons. When Mrs. H. claimed her family had once owned serfs, Mom's attention wandered. She had a tract house in mind. No way was she getting one. We were renting a remodeled garage behind the Giancarlo's, and Dad was basically drinking up the sporting goods store. His NFL helmets were years out of date. I'd stop by after school and find the store closed and Dad getting sloshed among the fake legs with Eddie Delmonico at Prosthetics World. Using the mold hero, I cast Mrs. H. a plastic Lafayette, and she said she'd keep it forever on her sill. But within a week, she'd given it to Elizabeth the Raccoon. I didn't mind. Raccoon, an only child like me, had nothing. The Klutz brothers called her Raccoon for the bag she had under her eyes from never sleeping. Her parents fought nonstop. They fought over breakfast. They fought in the yard in their underwear. At dusk, they stood on their porch whacking each other with lengths of weather stripping. Raccoon practically had spinal curvature from spending so much time slumped over with misery. When the Klutz brothers called her Raccoon, she indulged them by rubbing her hands together feralely. The nickname was the most attention she'd ever had. Sometimes she'd wish to be hit by a car so she could come back as a true raccoon and track down the Klutzes and give them rabies. "Never wish harm on yourself or others," Mrs. A said. "You are a lovely child." Her English was flat and clear, almost like ours. "Raccoon, you mean," Raccoon said. "A lovely raccoon." "A lovely child of God," Mrs. H. said. "You're right," Raccoon said. "Tell again about that prince." So Mrs. H. told again how she'd stood rapt in her yard, watching an actual prince powder his birthmark to invisibility. She remembered the smell of burning compost from the fields and men in colorful leggings dragging a gutted boar across a wooden bridge. This was before she was forced to become a human pack animal in the Carpathians, carrying the personal belongings of cruel officers. At night, they chained her to a tree. Sometimes they burned her calves with a machine gun barrel for fun, which is why she always wore knee socks. After 3 years, she'd come home to find her babies in tiny graves. They were, she would say, short-lived but wonderful gifts. She did not now begrudge God for taking them. A falling star is brief, but isn't one nonetheless glad to have seen it? Her grace made us hate Mrs. Poltoy all the more. What was eating a sixth of a potato every day compared to being chained to a tree? What was being crammed in with a bunch of your cousins compared to having your kids killed? Well, the summer I was 10, Raccoon and I, already borderline rejects due to our mutually unraveling households, were joined by Art Seminiak, who had recently made the mistake of inviting the Kletz brothers in for lemonade. There was no lemonade. Instead, there was Art's mom and a sailor from Great Lakes passed out naked across the paper drive stacks on the Seminiak sun porch. This new three-way friendship consisted of slumping in gangways, glovelessly playing catch with a wiffle ball, trailing hopefully behind kids whose homes could be entered without fear of fiasco. Over on Mozart Street lived Eddie the Vacant. Eddie was 17, huge and simple. He could crush a walnut in his bare hand, but first you had to put it there and tell him to do it. Once he'd pinned a vacant sign to his shirt and walked around the neighborhood that way, and the name had stuck. Eddie claimed to see birds. Different birds appeared on different days of the week. Also, there was a Halloween bird and a Christmas bird. One day, as Eddie hobbled by, we asked what kind of birds he was seeing. "Party birds," he said. "They got big streamers coming out their butts." "You having a party?" said Art. "You having a homo party?" I gonna have a birthday party," said Eddie, blinking shyly. "Your dad know?" Raccoon said. "No, he don't yet," said Eddie. His plans for the party were private and illogical. We peppered him with questions, hoping to get him to further embarrass himself. The party would be held in his garage. As far as the junk car in there, he would push it out by hand. As far as the oil on the floor, he would soak it up using handy wipes. As far as music, he would play a trumpet. "What are you going to play the trumpet with?" said Art. "Your asshole?" "No, I'm not going to play it with that," Eddie said. "I'm just going to use my lips, okay?" As far as girls, there would be girls. He knew many girls from his job managing the Drake Hotel, he said. As far as food, there would be food, including pudding dumplings. "You're the manager of the Drake Hotel," Raccoon said. "Hey, I know how to get the money for pudding dumplings," Eddie said. Then he rang Mrs. Poltoy's bell and asked for a contribution. She said, "For what?" He said, "For him." She said, "To what end?" He looked at her blankly and asked for a contribution. She asked him to leave the porch. He asked for a contribution. Somewhere he got the idea that when asking for a contribution, one angled to sit on the couch. He started in and she pushed him back with a thick forearm. Down the front steps he went, ringing the iron banister with his massive head. He got up and staggered away, a little blood on his scalp. "Learn to leave people be," Poltoy shouted after him. 10 minutes later, Eddie Sr. stood on Poltoy's porch, a hulking, effeminate tailor, too cowed to use his bulk for anything but butting open the jamming door at his shop. "Since when has it become the sport to knock unfortunates downstairs?" he asked. "He was not listen," she said. "I tell him no, he tried to come inside." "With all respect," he said, "it's in my son's nature to perhaps be not so responsive." "Someone so unresponsive, keep him indoors," she said. "He's big as a man, and I am old lady." "Never has Eddie presented a danger to anyone," Eddie Sr. said. "I know my rights," she said. "Next time I call police." But having been pushed down the stairs, Eddie the Vacant couldn't seem to stay away. "Off this porch," Poltoy said through the screen when he showed up the next day, offering her an empty cold cream jar for $3. "We can have so many snacks," he said, "and if I drink an alcohol drink, then watch out, because I ain't allowed. I dance too fast." He was trying the doorknob now, showing how fast he would dance if alcohol was served. "Please, off this porch," she shouted. "Please, off this porch," he shouted back, doubling at the waist in wacky laughter. Poltoy called the cops. Normally, Lieutenant Bruschi would have asked Eddie what bird was in effect that day and given him a ride home in his squad. But this was during the One City fiasco. To cut graft, cops were being yanked off their regular beats and replaced by cops from other parts of town. A couple Armenians from South Shore showed up and dragged Eddie off the porch in a club lock so tight he claimed the birds he was seeing were beakless. "I'll give you a beak, Frankenstein," said one of the Armenians, tightening the chokehold. Eddie entered the squad car with all the fluidity of a hat rack. Art and Raccoon and I ran over to Eddie Sr.'s tailor shop above the marquee, which had sunk to porn. When Eddie Sr. saw us, he stopped his singer by kicking out the plug. From downstairs came a series of erotic moans. Eddie Sr. rushed to the hospital with his purple heart and some photos of Eddie as a grinning, wet-chinned kid on a pony. He found Eddie handcuffed to a bed with an IV drip and a smashed face. Apparently, he'd bitten one of the Armenians. Bail was set at 300, and the tailor shop made zilch. Eddie Sr.'s fabrics were a lexicon of yesteryear. Dust coated a bright yellow sign that read, "Zippers repaired in Jiffy." "Jail for that kid, I admit, don't make total sense," the judge said. 3 months in the Anston, best I can do." The Anston Center for Youth was a red brick former forge, now yarded in barbed wire. After their shifts, the guards held loud hooting orgies kitty corner at Zem's lamplighter. Skinny immigrant women arrived at Zem's in station wagons and emerged hours later adjusting their stockings. From all over Chicago, kids came to the Anston, kids who'd only ever been praised for the level of beatings they gave and received and their willingness to carve themselves up. One Anston kid had famously hired another kid to run over his foot. Another had killed his mother's lover with a can opener. A third had sliced open his own eyelid with a pop top on a dare. Eddie the Vacant disappeared into the Anston Center in January and came out in March. To welcome him home, Eddie Sr. had the neighborhood kids over. Eddie the Vacant looked so bad, even the Kletz brothers didn't joke about how bad he looked. His nose was off center and a scald mark ran from ear to chin. When you got too close, his hands shot up. When the cake was served, he dropped his plate shouting, "Leave a guy alone!" Our natural meanness now found a purpose. Led by the Kletzes, we cut through Mrs. Poltoy's hose, bashed out her basement windows with ball peens, pushed her little shopping cart over the edge of the quarry, and watched it end over end into the former slag ravine. Then it was spring, and the quarry got busy. When the noon blast went off, our windows rattled. The 3 o'clock blast was even bigger. Raccoon and Art and I made a fort from the cardboard shipping containers the Klein frames came in. One day, while pretending the 3 o'clock blast was atomic, we saw Eddie the Vacant bounding toward our fort through the weeds like some lover in a commercial, only fatter and falling occasionally. His trauma had made us kinder toward him. "Eddie," Art said, "you tell your dad where you're at?" "It's no big problem," Eddie said. "I was going to leave my dad a note." "But did you?" said Art. "I'll leave him a note when I get back," Eddie said. "I can't come in with you now." "No room," said Raccoon. "You're too huge." "That's a good one," said Eddie, crowding in. Down in the quarry were the sad cats, the slumping watchman's shack, the piles of reddish discarded dynamite wrappings that occasionally rose erratically up the hillside like startled birds. Along the quarryside trail came Mrs. Poltoy dragging a new shopping cart. "Look at that pig," said Raccoon. "Eddie, that's the pig that put you away." "What did they do to you in there, Ed?" said Art. "Did they mess with you?" "No, they didn't," said Eddie. "I just say to them, leave a guy alone. I mean, sometimes they did, okay? Sometimes that one guy said, hey, Eddie, pull your thing. We gonna watch you." "Okay, okay," said Art. At dusk, the three of us would go to Mrs. H's porch. She'd bring out cookies and urge forgiveness. It wasn't Poltoy's fault her heart was small, she told us. She, Mrs. H, had seen a great number of things, and seeing so many things had enlarged her heart. Once she'd seen Goring. Once she'd seen Einstein. Once during the war, she'd seen a whole city block, formerly thick with furriers, bombed black overnight. In the morning, charred bodies had crawled along the street begging for mercy. One such body had grabbed her by the ankle, and she recognized it as Bergen, a friend of her father's. "What did you do?" said Raccoon. "Not important now," said Mrs. H., gulping back tears, looking off into the quarry. Then disaster. Dad got a check for shoulder pads for all six district football teams, and trying to work things out with Mom, decided to take her on a cruise to Jamaica. Nobody in our neighborhood had ever been on a cruise, and nobody had even been to Wisconsin. And the disaster was, I was staying with Mrs. Poltoy. Now, ours was a liquor household where you could ask a question over and over in utter sincerity and never get a straight answer. I asked and asked, why her? And was told and told, it will be an adventure. I asked, why not Grammy? I was told, Grammy don't feel well. I asked, why not Hopinlitsky? Dad did this like snort. Like, that's going to happen, said Mom. Why not? Why not? I kept asking. Because shut up, they kept answering. Just after Easter, over I went with my little green suitcase. I was a night panicker and occasional bedwetter. I'd wake drenched and panting. Had they told her? I doubted it. Then I knew they hadn't from the look on her face that first night when I peed myself and woke up screaming. "What's this?" she said. "Pee," I said, humiliated beyond any ability to lie. "Ugh, well," she said, "who don't? This also used to be me. Pee, pee, pee. I used to dream of a fish who cursed me." She changed the sheets gently, with no petulance, a new one on me. Often Ma, still half asleep, popped me with the wet sheet, saying, when at last I had a wife, she herself could finally get some freaking sleep. Then the bed was ready, and Poltoy made a sweeping gesture like, "Please." I got in. She stayed standing there. "You know," she said, "I know they say things about me what I done to that boy. But I had a bad time in the past with the big stupid boy. You don't gotta know. But I did like I did that day for good reason. I was scared at him due to something what happened for real to me." She stood in the half light, looking down at her feet. "Do you get?" she said. "Do you? Can you get at what I'm saying?" I think so, I said. "Tell to him," she said. "Tell to him, sorry. Explain about it. Tell your friends also, if you please. You have good brain. That's just why I'm saying to you." Something in me rose to this. I'd never heard it before, but I believed it. I had a good brain. I could be trusted to effect a change. Next day was Saturday. She made soup. We played a game using 3 slivers of soap. We made placemats out of colored strips of paper, and she let me teach her my spelling words. Around noon, the doorbell rang. At the door stood Mrs. H. "Everything okay?" she said, poking her head in. "Yes, fine," said Poulter. "I did not eat him yet." "Is everything really fine?" Mrs. H. said to me. "You can say." It's fine," I said. "You can say," she said fiercely. Then she gave Poltoy a look that seemed to say, "Hurt him and you will deal with me." "You silly woman," said Poltoy. "You're going now." Mrs. H. went. We resumed our spelling. It was tense in a quiet house way. Things ticked. When Poltoy missed a word, she pinched her own arm, but not hard. It was like symbolic pinching. Once when she pinched, she looked at me looking at her and we laughed. Then we were quiet again. "That lady," she finally said, "she like to lie. Maybe you don't know. She say she has come from where I come from?" "Yes," I said. "She is lie," she said. "She act so sweet and everything, but she lie. She been born in Skokie. Live here all her life in America. Why you think she talk so good?" All week, Poltoy made sausage, noodles, potato pancakes. We ate like pigs. She had tea and cakes ready when I came home from school. At night, if necessary, she dried me off, moved me to her bed, changed the sheets, put me back with never an unkind word. We'll pass," she'd hum. Mom and Dad came home tanned with a sailor cap for me, and in a burst of post-vacation honesty confirmed it. Mrs. H. was a liar and a kook. Nothing she said was true. She'd been a cashier at Goldblatt's but had been caught stealing. When caught stealing, she'd claimed to be with the main office. When a guy from the main office came down, she claimed to be with the FBI. Then she'd produced a letter from Lady Bird Johnson, but in her own handwriting, with Johnson spelled J-O-N-S-E-N. I told the other kids what I knew, and in time, they came to believe it, even the Klutz brothers. And once we believed it, we couldn't imagine we hadn't seen it all along. Another spring came. Once again, birds nested in bushes on the sides of the quarry. A thrown rock excited a thrilling upwards explosion. Thin rivers originated in our swampy backyards, and we sailed boats made of flattened shoeboxes, Twinkie wrappers, crimped tinfoil. Raccoon glued together 3 balsa wood planes and placed on this boat a turd from her dog Svengoolie. And as Svengoolie's turd went over a little waterfall and disappeared into the quarry, we cheered. Thank you so much for your attention.
That concludes the reading for this event. Next up is the conversation.
Very generous audience.
They're one of the best audiences, yeah. I know, in fact. and we shouldn't talk about them in front of their faces.
But don't they change it? Aren't they different people every time, though? Or it's kind of...
No. I think they're always the same.
Okay.
In fact, I'm always tempted to come out and say, last time we were talking, we were talking about popular art.
That's right.
And I thought we'd continue to talk about popular art, because one of the things that George Sanders' stories have shown is that a short story can be in The New Yorker without the point being so discreet and subtle that you'd have to read it two or three times before you decide it must be about...
Sometimes you don't even have to read it once. You just kind of, you know, hit that first paragraph and move on.
Yeah, the pastel colors start to fade very quickly.
Yeah.
But I wanted to talk to you because it is popular speech, satire, comedy, popular assumptions, and real American underclass language going on in these stories. And talk about your background a bit and how you came to feel safe using that kind of diction in a story.
Well, I was raised on the south side of Chicago, and in some ways a very literary culture, because there were a lot of stories and a lot of, you could kind of get over by telling a story, if you could be funny or whatever. But then I think maybe like a lot of working class people, I assume that art was that thing that that you couldn't quite do, and you'd have to fundamentally change yourself to do it. So I went to grad school at Syracuse and kind of got sucked up in this project of trying to be a real conventional realist writer, which I don't have any gift for. So for a long time, I was trying to make that work and imitating Hemingway slavishly, which is kind of silly because given my life, it was, you know, Nick walked into the Walmart. It was pleasant, you know. But somehow I just wanted so badly to be him that I couldn't, you know, omit certain data, you know, in order to be Hemingway. So then after many years in grad school, and we had our two daughters, and I was kind of at the end of my rope. I was working at an engineering company, and I was probably about 30-ish, so my idea of being a child prodigy had kind of passed. And so just in that kind of, it wasn't, you know, it was a decent job, but it wasn't what I had planned for myself. And sort of in that heat, I thought, oh, God. And I was in a conference call one time, and I just wrote a bunch of little silly kind of limericks almost, just out of boredom, and brought them home, and my wife read them. And I, from the next room, I heard her laughing, which she hadn't laughed at one of my stories in years. And all I ever got was that reaction every writer dreads, which is, interesting. Very interesting, you know. I liked your use of the color blue, and but she was actually laughing. So that was one thing. And I had a good friend of mine. I had one silly story I wrote way back when, and he said, you know, that's really what you should do. So somehow the combination effect of those things, it was literally like just a gate opening up, you know. And I teach writing now, and I'm always trying to keep in mind that that's a real possibility. That it might not be gradual and craft based. It might just be a little floodgate of a sort of a permission giving that you do to yourself. So as soon as I said you can make fart jokes, you can use the language you actually use, you can go towards pathos in a way that feels authentic, suddenly it was so fun and easy, and I never lacked an answer. I always knew what to do next. Whereas in the Hemingway days, I would just think, what would Hem have done? And I would go chase a bull, or you know, get in a fight in Havana. And it was, it really was nothing more than the low-hanging fruit that's in front of you your whole life. And you know, my father is a great storyteller. But of course, during those years, that was roped off. That's just dad. But once you start to see that you can't go far from your natural inclination and do much, then it sort of opened up.
So now tell the truth, though. How did most of these end up in The New Yorker?
I don't know. I mean, the first one was I sent it to them over the transom, you know, that kind of thing. And actually, they rejected two or three, and then they took this one from the first book. And I was very surprised, and it was the first issue that Tina Brown edited. So I think they had a little bit of a, hey, let's get somebody trashy in there just to show how hip we are. So they paired me. Of course, being the bastion of integrity that I am, I refused. But it was in there with a story by John Updike, and it was very pointedly, the cover of the magazine had a sort of classic Central Park cab driver in a big top hat, and this little hippie kind of sprawled, you know, with a Walkman. So I think I was supposed to be him somehow. But so that was one story. And that was about another 4 years before I got another one in there. But I think it was Dan Menneker was there at the time, and then Bill Buford, who came later, was a real advocate. And he's also from a working class background. So I think maybe we had a little simpatico going there.
Now, in the course of this, it seems as if the stories, while remaining vulgar, have gotten stylistically more and more complex and refined. And again, you know, well, in one of the stories, a character is told that he's going to have to pull himself up by his bootstrap. Mm-hmm. And the character says, well, what's a bootstrap? And right. The other character says, a strap on a boot.
I think she actually says, it's a strap on a boot, you doof.
I left out the you doof.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's, I
appreciate it. Out of politeness.
I know, I appreciate it.
But tell me about these stories becoming more complex.
Well, it's an issue because I think, you know, when you're a youngish writer, and you're desperate to try to find something that feels like home to you, you really will do whatever it takes. And in that time, I was really desperate and really hungry. And, you know, I'd never been published, so you didn't really think about it being vulgar and going out. But I think writing is sort of like, this will be a crude analogy, but it's like if you had one shirt that made you look great, and you whenever you wore that shirt, you just felt like a better person, you know? And then you had a big date. Somebody
are you talking about me?
No, I'm not talking. You had several nice shirts. But you had this one shirt, and you have a big date. Then this is really important. You want this to really work. So you go to your closet. You put on the shirt. The only pants that you have to match it make your ass look humongous. Let's just say. No, it's not about you. So then you're faced with a choice. You can wear your second best shirt and some pants that make your butt look smaller, or you can throw caution to the wind and say, I'm going with my best shirt, and I'm going to have a big ass. So writing for me, because I'm a very limited talent, it's very much like that. I'll do a story, get halfway into it, and go, oh my God, what am I doing here? This is not Chekhov. You know, I didn't want to write this kind of story. But then you think, well, I did it sincerely. I have to finish it. So it's kind of like you put a story out and you're cringing a little because you know better than anyone the defects. And I know better than anyone the limits of vulgarity. But at the same time, whenever I try consciously to pull out of that natural mode, the result is brown shirt, medium-sized ass. So you're following my metaphor here. But it's not, you know, often when writers...
Can we talk about something else?
Yeah, no, actually, I'm not quite done with this. Let's talk shoes. Shoes. No. But I think the point is that if you know, I think often when you put something out into the world, people assume that you believe in it 100%. And for me, it's much more like one of those Chinese thumb things. Oh, this will be fun. Ugh. And so then you're trying to get out of the story any way you can, and you have to accept the defects with the pluses.
Well, one of the things I've noticed, it used to be that that in a story of this kind, right, the lower class, you know, underclass American would arrive in the story to tell the homely truth. They would be the point of the story. And the point of the story would be you can learn from anyone.
Right.
You know?
But mostly the poor.
But mostly the poor.
Yeah.
The poor know more than anyone.
Right. Right.
I don't know if you've noticed.
Oh, yeah. No, they do. And also, sometimes midgets are very smart. And space aliens are also very wiser than us.
Space aliens have things to teach us.
But
the poor learn it in poor school.
But, you know, Chekhov, he said this. Chekhov's grandfather was a peasant. And he said, regarding Tolstoy, he said, I'm of peasant stock, and you cannot fool me with peasant virtues. So, you know, I think the more humanitarian view is to say that anyone can be compassionate and wise. And it's certainly, I mean, you could make the argument that being poor makes you miserable and angry and bitter. And, you know, so I think it's, yeah.
Can you say that?
But also, but I mean, the other beautiful truth is that there are some poor people who are transcendent. So, you know.
And the way these stories work, it seems to me, is that whereas once the poor were the voice of truth in a story, here the poor are the voice of America, and they're saying these American things in an uninterrupted way, and the story is doing something equally astonishing. It's saying to its reader,
Oh, you don't get it. I am going to laugh at fat people and retards. Mm-hmm. I am. Mm-hmm. You see what you can do about it.
Right.
But I'm going to throw these things around so much that you're not going to know what direction truth is going to come flying at you from, mm-hmm. because truth has to come in somewhere. And somehow or other, the laugh has to end up on someone's face. And the reader of these stories doesn't know where it's going to come from. There's a whoopee cushion, but it's often under the wrong butt.
Right.
I can do you better.
Okay. If this is going to become some kind of butt contest, you're not going to win, buddy. No. I agree. One thing I think is true of fiction, and it's I aspire to this, but I haven't done it yet, is we talked about this briefly the other day, but there's a story that sounds like a joke, but it's not. Gorky and Tolstoy were walking down the street in Moscow, and Gorky records this in his memoirs. And Tolstoy, at this point, was 700 years old and just declared his celibacy, and was forcing his daughters to be celibate, although they were 20. He sees a couple of Cossacks or hussars or whatever coming up the street, talking, clanking with their swords, and big-shouldered guys. And he turns to Gorky and he says, "That's what's wrong with Russia. This mindless, macho, militarist aggression is going to be the death of Russia." And he talks about this, and Gorky is absolutely transfixed and convinced. And then these guys pass by in this cloud of cologne, and Tolstoy, this little old man, turns on his heels and says, "On the other hand, that's what's beautiful about Russia." And he does an equal and opposite argument for these guys being perfect. And I think that's, in some confused way, I'm trying to do something like that, which is to say, again, I'm quoting the Russian, but Chekhov said, art doesn't solve problems, it just formulates them correctly. So if you can put this truth beautifully, truthfully, and this one that's contradictory side by side, then I think the thing that literature is supposed to do, which is sort of stun you for a minute, stun you out of your habitual concepts, stun you into a kind of openness, even if for a couple seconds, then you've accomplished that. Now, what happens after that, I don't know, but I think if you can get that little second of just, then that's really a lot of work.
Now, I first met George when the second book, Pastoralia, came out. The year was 2000. I did an interview with him on Bookworm. And I told him what was true at the time, that sometimes I felt that he was building the stories with one misfortune after another, befalling a character. And I felt that life does this to people. But in a short story, the author could give us a little break and let the character have a little bit more light. Mm-hmm. And that the author who wouldn't forgive a character or give him a break was something of a sadist.
Right.
And that I was very serious about this at the time. Turns out I'm sort of wrong. But I once actually asked David Levitt, who was writing about his mother's death from cancer, what was it like to go upstairs to your death and kill your mother a little bit more every day? Because I think that writing has a job to save people a little bit. And the brutal truth, well, there used to be a saying, shelter the wind from the shorn lamb. Mm-hmm. Just after you cut the lamb's hair, don't put him out in the blizzard. Mm-hmm. Let him stay indoors and warm up a little bit. Mm-hmm. The tenderness and concern. And you, at that time, stopped and said, "I can't answer that."
I was kind of stunned by that question at the time. And I thought about it a lot since. So.
And what's gone on since?
Well, one thing I thought about was this, that maybe because the writer has 100% leeway, you can say whatever you want. You can make whatever events you want to make occur. Maybe that part gets taken off the table. In other words, if the writer starts out to say, "I'm going to write a life where everything was golden." Everything. I was just reading American Pastoral, and Levov, I think, is the Swede in that book. A blessed guy who, at least as far as I've read, he's had a wonderful life. That's one way to tell a story. The other way is Job. You can choose that. And I'm going to say that it doesn't matter. That's an arbitrary choice. If I have the guy always falling down the stairs or levitating above it with a supermodel, Either way, it's kind of an arbitrary start to a story. Once there was a man who was always happy. Once there was a man who was always sad. Arbitrary. But I think that the redemptive part of fiction comes in what the person does in response to what happens to them. So if you have a story where something bad happens, and the meaning is in how he responds. And I think also with the lucky man, the same idea. So I think, honestly, we tell the stories we do because of some kind of neurological predisposition. In my family, the stories my dad told were always dark. They always had strange characters. They were always way fast. And the only redemptive thing was that he was telling it to you, and you were laughing so hard you were crying. And you understood that as affection from him. So was it redemption in those stories? Yeah, you bet. You know, because there was a glimmer of hope. He was telling you the story joyfully, so therefore we are okay. So I think, now having said that, I also aspire to a richer kind of storytelling where the actual blessings that I've had in my life make it into the story. You know, I'm 46, two beautiful kids, beautiful wife, very fortunate. So it sometimes I think, I wonder if I could be a better writer and let that light in a little bit more. A lot of it came out of that talk that we had. But
one of the things you see, I think, and you'll all pardon me, you know I'm very bitter, right? I think you see that what happened in the interim is that American life became so brutal and vicious that you, no matter what you did to a character, it seemed real. Mm. You know what I mean? Our attitudes toward the poor, our attitudes toward foreigners, our attitudes toward generosity. You know, if I was reading Marilynne Robinson, who said, there's nothing more important in the Bible, in the Christian Bible, than the idea of giving to the poor unto giving everything you have to the poor. How can they say we're living in a Christian country when we dislike the poor and think that they are doing something wrong? That they are this way. So what happened, I think, to George's stories is that life got more and more horrible, and therefore he no longer seemed like a sadist. America seemed like the sadist.
By next year, I'll be the chairman of Disney. I'll be so... But, you know, I think I don't want to assume the politics of the room, but I think one thing I've been thinking about... in the last 6 months especially, I had a number of essays that I published on Slate and The New Yorker, and I got really worked up about the war and so on. And somewhere along the line, I felt that I wanted to pull back just a little bit and rethink that Chekhovian idea, you know, that art doesn't solve problems, it formulates them correctly. It's an open question. It's a puzzle to me whether people are good or bad. And I think it's in the juxtaposition of the contrast, you know, because you have Abu Ghraib, and you have the thousands, millions of acts of kindness that people do every day. And those things they're both true. And I think, again, putting those together somehow, if I could do it, would make a beautiful spark that has the effect of opening your eyes for a couple of seconds. And as a writer, too, that you could say, yeah, that's true and that's true. It's very scary to exist in that place where you're not sure which is really true. But after September 11th, I had that uncanny feeling of really not knowing what to think. And my God, it's like you're in the middle of the ocean scrambling for a shore to try to have some easy opinion so you can just get to sleep at night. But I think that state is very healthy. To be perennially confused is probably, you know, an enviable state.
Now, along with this question about sleeping at night, though, when you're writing well, do you sleep better?
No, I sleep pretty well all the time. Really, I don't. For me, writing is only fun in the last 2 or 3 weeks when I realize that the story I've made is going to actually have an ending that will work. And that phase where you're refining it is wonderful, where you kind of see, okay, this story has a shape. It's going to work. It's not bullshit. It's actually got something that might speak to me if I was a reader. Then it's really a lot of fun. And before that, I write about 2 stories a year, and I do a lot of really obsessive moving things around, which isn't all that pleasant, really. But I know that if I don't do it, the story is lesser than it would be otherwise. But those last 2 weeks are pretty good.
And sometimes they take 4 years.
That one I just read, this is embarrassing, it took 8. Because I started it and set it aside and came back and went, oh, I don't get it. Because originally my idea was that both women were telling the truth. And so the story became some kind of weird grad school construction about, you know, a good person can be bad, and a bad person can be mean. And try finishing that story, you know, except you just write in big letters, duh, at the bottom of So I kept working, and my working on it would be to come back every, you know, so often and read it and say, God, I don't know. And I noticed, this is an interesting thing about, Stuart Dybeck says that a writer learns to listen to the story talks to you. And every time I got to the part in that story where the lying woman tells about her Eastern European adventure the first time, about, about the machine guns and all that stuff, I felt a little, because I knew I'd written that under the sway of Isaac Babel. And I was stuck in my office job, and I wanted to write something Eastern European and kind of, you know, kind of lush. And every time I read it, I'd go, ooh, kind of like if you caught yourself making a pose in a mirror that was a little bit stupid. And not that I would ever do that. So I would get to that point, and every time, just that little tiny bit of your mind would say, ugh, cut it. And I'd cut it, and then something would go off in the story. So I just left it there time after time. And just one day, I was writing, and I just went in, took a shower, actually, and I went, huh, she's a liar. The reason you think you're a liar, you're not. You're great. She's a liar. And suddenly the story was, I finished it in an afternoon, because that was what the story was saying. You know, it's so interesting, and it's really such a great life to be able to dig yourself into a hole like that. And then, you know, I mean, my wife and I are Buddhists, and one of the things that practice teaches you is that whatever's going on in your mind is okay. So in the writing space, you're sitting there and you're watching the story and you're really trying to see what you would be thinking if you were a reader. Not what you hoped, you know, not what you would like to legislate, but what your mind is really doing. And then sometimes it'll give you an answer like that.
Now, in the first story in Civil War Land and Bad Decline, some ghosts appear and they have some very important things to say about the Civil War that told to the narrator, get him a raise and a job. So ghosts are very helpful in your work. And in the most famous story, or at least my favorite story, isn't that better?
Yeah. Both are good.
What's fame? Sea Oak in Passeralia. And Bernie comes back from the dead, this time scattering limbs. I mean, her ears fall off and an arm falls off and her head. Now, what's next for the ghosts?
I have some right now in a story. And it's funny because it's an element. It's almost like a Greek chorus. And so the only requirement I have is that I try to use them in a slightly different way than before. So I have a story now that has the narrator is a guy whose parents were murdered, and but they're still with him. And they're just there, and he comes home, and only he can see them. And I was writing along, and I had at the end of the first section just this little thing that said, I do this work, and I go home to my dazzling children, my wonderful wife. And I thought, I have trouble writing that. So I just said, I wish. And then I said, okay, now he's going to go home where? To his parents. And I thought, oh, God, you've done that one too many times, the guy who lives with his parents. So then I just, somehow that just, the idea that they were there but dead was interesting. and then it's just a matter of trying to, like, you know, like when you do drywall, you're trying to just hide the crack. So you have, you know, to say, I'm putting a ghost in the story, everyone says, oh, please. And so then it just becomes a matter of the hustle, which I'm, you know, as a salesman's son, I'm familiar with this. You now, okay, there are ghosts, and I'm going to make them palatable to you. So, and then once you have them in there, they become something. They become about something. And you don't really know what, but that's the job, is to find out why are they there, you know, what does it mean to him, and so on. So I like to use them. It gives you a chance, well, I think it gives me a chance with my limited range to talk about the fact that we're, you know, this is amazing that we're sitting here and that in X number of years, no one will be left. And yet we go around and we talk about things in a civilized way, and we choose chicken over pork, and we, you know, and we have childhood memories, but in X number of years, it's all gone. And I find that beautiful, and I have a feeling it's important. You know, if we could internalize that, it might change the way we live. So having a ghost come back is kind of a great way of just putting it right in.
Now, I have the feeling, in fact, you know, Art Spiegelman once said to me that Art Crumb, that Robert Crumb had scolded him. He said about the younger ones, the younger cartoonists, you guys are just a bunch of moralists. Mm-hmm. I didn't do that. I don't want to change the way any of you live. I think you should be as disgusting as you want. Right. But Art Spiegelman felt, no, we don't want to be as disgusting as you want us to be. I think you are a moralist too.
I'm a seriously obnoxious moralist. And a seriously obnoxious sentimentalist. So a lot of my life as a writer has been to try to work with those things in a way that make them less obnoxious, really. I mean, the Civil War land conceit just came because I was so Hemingwayed up, you know, that I couldn't write a sentence that wasn't so earnest. It was, you know, not earnest. Where's the snare drum when you need it? Oh, God. But I'm very much a moralist.
Than I.
Yeah, right. He wins the butt thing, and I get the. But I think it's sort of a problem for me because I do see the world in very, very simplistic moral terms. So I think some of the struggle I have as a writer is to try to make sure that there's enough complexity in there to honor the other side of a given argument.
Now, because coupled with that morality, has come a new relentlessness. Those of you who had the luck to look at last month's issue of, what was it? Was it Harper's or the
Harper's? Atlantic?
Of Harper's. Saw a short story about a TV family. But with every episode, they get worse. And eventually, you know, characters are arriving with vulvas cut into their foreheads and all sorts of extremist things, and the moral father is thrown out of the house because he's too boring. You have to have higher ratings all the time. What is this about this man who wants to bring the homeless into the house? That's not going to be good television.
Right.
So they kick him more and more and more.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, you know, he's really bringing in, he's going to make this point, and he's going to twist the knife in the face of the reader to say, we don't live good lives.
Right.
We're not good people. We want to be entertained. What is relentlessness doing in your work now?
Well, I've got to a point where, and my wife helped me with this, she said, why don't you just do what you do? Don't worry about it. Just be ranting in every direction, without being such a Catholic about it. Just don't worry about it. You're not that good. You're not that popular. And, you know, if you write something sacrilegious, nobody even reads it. It doesn't, you know. So just knock yourself out.
Now,
you know?
I know why you married
yeah,
her.
Yeah, I know. She's great. So my thought was, you know, you have to follow the story to its logical conclusion. That was a pretty dark story. It surprised me. But having done it, that was another 3-year deal. And so I thought, well, I had it up to 104 pages and cut it down to 20. So I know that story inside and out, and I know that stylistically I couldn't have done otherwise. So then I think, okay, that's a gift from my subconscious. It's telling a certain truth. Do I believe it? I don't know. But I mean, I just read Dylan's book, and he said, the way I write a song is sometimes I say what I know to be true, sometimes I say what I know isn't true, and sometimes I don't know if it's true or not. And I thought that's a great way to liberate yourself as a writer and be more productive, is just say, today I'm inhabiting this truth. Forgive me. I don't know whether it's absolutely true or not, but see if it rings a bell. If it rings a bell with you, there must be some component of truth in it. And that's why I say, you know, that's the big but. I have that story that I think, oh my God, I don't feel that way. But that is a way to feel. So I think that's the way I sort of defend it, I guess. But that's a dark story, but funny, I hope. You know, it's
funny. Really funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. All right.
You know, this one who his wife says nobody reads will be signing books in the lobby. So why don't you demonstrate the wrongness of that by everyone joining in that line back there. He'll be signing them all. Thank you for coming.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.